The Old Testament, the second book of Samuel, chapters 5 and 6. The Philistines, after their resounding victory at Gilboa with the death of King Saul and his three sons, would have been mortified if they to know, as they did learn, that David within 7 years had been proclaimed king of all Israel. First 7 years king of Judah, his own tribe, then king of all Israel. So they prepared for battle. But David heard the Lord would attend to that, and when the Philistines approached Jerusalem from the precipitous southwest that I was describing beside the hospital under Jerusalem, David did the right thing. He inquired of the Lord. That's the thing to do when there's a problem. Inquire of the Lord. The thing our beleaguered prime minister should do when they come at him from all angles, poor chap. Inquire of the Lord. He has an opinion in everything, doesn't he? Why don't we ask him more? Why don't we trust him more? And the Lord gave David permission to attack, which was virtually handing him victory on a plate. And it was such a victory that David had to exclaim about the Lord breaking out on Israel's behalf as waters to overwhelm, practically drown the Philistines. So David called the place of it that, the place of God's breaking out. But the Philistines tried again. The devil doesn't know when he's defeated. He has to be told. I suppose he can't help it. What else can he do? The Philistines wanted that Judean ridge, and doubtless also recently seized Jerusalem. They wanted it, where David was building his palace. So David wisely inquired of the Lord again. There's nothing like keeping at it with the Lord. Nothing. Nothing. It pays. He pays. He always pays his dividends. But you see, the Lord seldom uses the same tactics twice. He doesn't need to. After all, he has infinite ingenuity, and he likes to keep his enemies guessing. So he said to David, don't go straight up this time, but circle round behind them and wait for the breeze which will stir the balsam trees, for it will really come from angelic cohorts. A bit like with Elisha, Dothan. Do you remember that? Chariots of fire that protected Elisha at Dothan. So, it was these angelic spiritual forces which were to give the victory to David this time. No arms, no swords, no bows and arrows, no. So David did as he was bid, and although it was given him and his men to strike down the Philistines, it was undoubtedly the angelic spiritual forces which had the Philistines on the run. It was spiritual. It wasn't physical. And you see, this is another example of how few of Israel's victories over her enemies were ever of actual warfare. Very little to do with swords and weapons. apart, of course, from the inevitable rout and pursuit that followed. You see, most of the victories that God gave Israel over her enemies were what we would call in the nature of psychological warfare, but perhaps spiritual warfare is a better term. What do you think? How much, as I was saying before, how much more we should let our God fight our battles? Why don't we? He's the fighter. He's God's only worker, the Holy Spirit. I wonder now, when I say that, how would you apply that to your own battles? I must think of it in relation to mine, and I do. And I say to myself, you think for yourself, let me think for myself. Could it have anything to do with preaching and its results? Certainly it has much to do with praying, for sure. But that has a lot to do with preaching, too. You stop praying, and my preaching would soon fizzle out. I'm surer of that than I am of most things. Surer of that than I am of most things. Oh, yes. Assuming, then, that David is now in residence in Jerusalem, and with his palace built on the way, his first thought is of the Ark of the Covenant, which had been returned from the Philistines about 20 years before and dumped in the place called Kiriath-Yearim. The leader called it Baala, in the foothills beneath Jerusalem. And the Ark hadn't been consulted as the oracle by Israel all that long time. Practically 20 years without prayer. Awful. They were so taken up, you see, with enemies and that sort of thing. Outward things. So, as we may read in 1 Chronicles chapters 13 and 15, David sent out a message far and wide after his victories over the Philistines. He sent out a message far and wide, almost from Egypt to Lebanon, to summon Israel or their representatives for the bringing up of the Ark to Jerusalem, God's city where God wanted to dwell. And it was to be a huge procession with pageantry and soldiers galore. And David would know how to direct that, of course. He would have been a master at that, as well as at so many other things. One of the most gifted men who ever lived, David must have been. But in their eagerness to prepare for this great procession, and even perhaps their rashness to make a great thing of it, they ignored the facts which, if David had been sufficiently guided by the priesthood, should have been staring him in the face, that the Ark was the focus of God's presence among them, and therefore had to be treated with the greatest of awe and circumspection, as if God's holy living presence was in that box, or was potently focusing on it and its sacred content, the Ten Commandments, the two tables of the law, retrieved from Mount Sinai and written on by the finger of God. That ark, therefore, had to be carried a very special way, lest any mere man touch it. It was to be slung on poles through rings and thus carried inviolate of any human hand. But no, they had to have a new cart built to carry it. Them and their new carts and new cars and newfangled everything which ignores all the history, the tradition, and all the invaluable and significant lore of God's ways with men of earlier days. Away with the past, say these youthful and even elderly ignoramuses, who would turn our ancient past into a mere fairground, a playground for senseless instant fun with its cultic and demonic overtones. Halloween my foot. I gave a kid with a devil's mask such a fright on Monday night, begging money, that he scurried down the path at breakneck speed. But we'll see what sort of paganry Malcolm Savage concocts for these new Christmas lights on Union Street. We'll see if there's any reference to Christmas and Christ in them at all. Now, Malcolm Savage, the big wig, you see, of the local government now, who should know better, you see, from years of sitting, worshipping in this church, and professing to be a very reformed Christian from Surrey, and even brought Peter Humphreys to this church from his digs to become one of our most fruitful ministers. Now, Malcolm, if your lights have no Christmas theme, you'll be hearing about it, and perhaps publicly too. You're accustomed to publicity, for your name and your face is often in the papers. But you see, it's so important that we should, if we're going to recognize Christmas at all, honor what it means and not all the silly fairy tales that go with it and all that rubbish about Halloween, which basically was a pagan festival which should have absolutely nothing to do with it. But there's two vital things to note here. David becomes, and we're going away far back to the beginning of the Bible here, David becomes part of a Paul, P-A-L-L, a Paul of ignorance of origins. Oh, you mustn't forget the origins. You mustn't forget the beginning of Genesis 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 and so on. Oh, no. He became a part of fallen mankind's Paul of ignorance of origins. Which origins go back in this case to Genesis chapter 2 before the fall? While after the fall in Genesis 3, men were led to the most appalling departures from what God had laid down in Genesis 2, and which became so clear with Moses in the 7th commandment and the 10 commandments with regard to sexual irregularities. Hence David's concubine, which were common among pagan kings, and he may have assumed that he had the same right to concubines as these heathen kings. No, he hadn't. Not God's king. But David didn't seem to know. He was utterly ignorant of Genesis 2. Or if he wasn't, he completely ignored it and paid for it. He and Solomon and their line with the utter ruination of Israel ultimately. That's the first thing. The second thing is he was ignorant of, although, mind you, his contact with the priests during his fugitive days should have enlightened him about this. The second thing he was ignorant of was how to treat the ark. Now note these two things, the sex and the ignorance of God's holy ways with his people. For you see, although the word doesn't always say a lot about certain vital things like marriage, It says it in Genesis 2, and there's nothing until Moses' commandment, the seventh commandment, and very little until Jesus came. You see? He just says it and leaves it. Stated in Genesis 2, then the commandment about what, hundreds of years later, yet what it says is vital, is a vital factor, which Israel, including David, ignoring, led to the ruin of the nation of Israel. And the lesson that Israel had to learn in the end was that God was obliged to work with a mere remnant of his people. Only a remnant of 12 tribes of Israel were of any use to God at all, just a remnant. And that's what the church is called, you know. The church in the Greek language is the ecclesia. Ecclesia. And that comes from a word in its prefix, ex kaleo, to call out. To call out from the generality of an apostate people, a remnant for himself. And that's what the church is, a remnant of a remnant of a remnant. So, they put the ark on this new cart to carry it up that way. And of course, remember, that's what the Philistines had done when they returned the ark to Israel. They got a new cart. But of course, you remember, they had already suffered many disasters from the presence of this lively, potent chest, the ark amongst them, that I believe God had mercy on the Philistines carrying the ark on a cart. But Israel should have known better than put their most sacred artifact on a cart. Look at the rings, but where are the poles? And you see, it was a long, rough road up these foothills to Jerusalem. And the cart was like to sway, and even threatened to topple. God's mercy! The sacred ark tumble? Surely never! Yes! And so, innocent Uzzah, son of Abinadab, who had looked after the ark for 20 years, protectively put out his hand to steady it, and died outright. I think God's anger was more at David and the neglect of the priest than at the poor man himself, although he did wrong. You see, the ark was living, potent, lethal to the uninitiated. God was living. Whether you would say he was living in it or around it, or over it, he was there. And so when the poor man died, absolute consternation. So the ark didn't reach Jerusalem that day, and while it remained in the house of Obed-Edom, his house was blessed, because he wouldn't touch it, not for the world would he touch it. He respected it and feared it, as they all did after that, of course. So David, having prepared a tent for the ark in Jerusalem, That was why, you remember, later, next chapter, David wanted to build a temple for the Lord, because he was embarrassed that while he dwelt in a palace of cedar, the ark of God remained in a tent. So he saw to it this time that the priesthood, who of course were the source of knowledge of these sacred Levitical things, this priesthood were properly consulted, and the ark was brought safely to the capital city as it should have been, carried on poles. Now, there's a parallel account of this history that we were reading in 2 Samuel in 1 Chronicles 15. And I'm going to read a little bit there. 1 Chronicles 15, 11. And this is what happened. Then David summoned Zadok and Abiathar the priests, which he should have done before, and Uriel, Asaiah, Joel, Shemaiah, Eliel, and Abinadab, the Levites. And he said to them, "You are the heads of the Levitical families. You and your fellow Levites are to consecrate yourselves and bring up the ark of the Lord, the God of Israel, to the place I have prepared for it." Now notice this. It was because you, the Levites, did not bring it up the first time that the Lord our God broke out in anger against us. Poor Uzzah. We did not inquire of him about how to do it in the prescribed way. You see that? So the priests and the Levites consecrated themselves in order to bring up the ark of the Lord, the God of Israel, and the Levites carried the ark of God with the poles on their shoulders, as Moses had commanded, in accordance with the word of the Lord. And if you were to move to verse 29, you would read, "And because God had helped the Levites who were carrying the ark of the covenant of the Lord, seven bulls and rams were sacrificed." Now, David was clothed in a linen ephod, as were all the Levites who were carrying the ark, as were the singers, and Kenaniah was in charge of the choirs. So all Israel brought up the ark with shouts, with the sounding of ram's horns and trumpets and cymbals, and the playing of lyres and harps. But our own chapter says, when those who were carrying the ark had taken six steps, see how afraid they are now. David sacrificed a bull and a fattened calf. Well, they wouldn't have gone on very fast at that rate, would they? Six steps. And David, wearing his linen ephod, danced before the Lord with all his might, while he and the entire house of Israel brought up the ark of the Lord with shouts and the sounds of trumpets. Well, that was a day, was it not? Ah! But the next verse of our chapter, and of 1 Chronicles 15:29, tells another story. You see, the devil is always at hand, or is as near as can he get, when there's something good going on, to try to mar a good and glorious thing. Never forget that. Never forget that he's always around. And the nearer we are to God and to God's blessing, the more he's intent on spoiling it. What a spoiler he is. Even our joy, and we were talking about the joy of the Lord last night in David's penitential Psalm 51, even our joy in the Lord should always, oh, are you listening to this? Our joy in the Lord should always be tinctured with care and caution. Watch that brute. You see, as the ark of God was entering the city of David, Michal, Saul's daughter, and David's wife, watched from a window. Well, were there no women on the streets that day? Oh, yes, as the text goes on to say. But she wasn't among them. Well, she was still a Benjamite, you know, daughter of Saul. And she may not have been as enamored of her husband, wonderful fellow as David was, as her brother Jonathan was, you remember. Jonathan thought David was marvelous. She didn't seem to think so, not today at any rate. And when she saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, she despised him in her heart. She didn't know that it was before the Lord. She wouldn't know about that, I don't think. But she despised him in her heart. Was she jealous, do you think? Because the Lord was first in David's life, eh? The Lord is always, we'll be talking on that on the subject of guidance and marriage tonight. The Lord is always to be first. Before everybody. And perhaps she didn't like that. Nonetheless, David, ignorant of all this and her looking out at the window, proceeded to celebrate with special food for all the people. And then he returned home, doubtless exhausted after his exertions, intending to bless his home, but was met with a terrible rebuff from his own wife. Out she came to meet him. How the king of Israel distinguished himself today, disrobing in front of the slave girls of his servants as any vulgar fellow would. And he said, it was before the Lord I did it. And then he simply couldn't resist this. This wouldn't have helped the marriage. The Lord, it was before the Lord I did it. The Lord who chose me rather than your father, Saul, or any from his house, when he appointed me ruler over the Lord's people Israel. Poor, poor Michael. That was her deeply hurt. And didn't she suffer for it? But David was aglow. I will celebrate, he says. I will celebrate. Sport is how one of the translators puts that word, celebrate. I will celebrate, he says. Before the Lord. I will become, and this is what I wanted you to notice, I will become even more undignified than this, and I will be humiliated in my own eyes. Now, I think that last statement by David about being humiliated in his own eyes is perhaps more significant than the commentators suppose. So I wanted to see what dear old Matthew Henry had to say on the matter. And the first thing he says is that ministers who bless the people should also bless their own homes. All right then. And that would apply, of course, to office bearers and members of the congregation as well as the minister, wouldn't it? Do you bless your home from the Lord when you go home on the Sabbath? Do you take the Lord's blessing home? Hope you do. Well, Matthew Henry goes on to speak eloquently of David's humility, and indeed his humiliation of himself. But I couldn't get even a hint of what I'd hoped to get from Matthew Henry there. Namely, that for David to express such abasement before the Lord linked him, at least in my mind, for David's expression is very extreme, you see, the humiliation, linked him with our Lord's unutterable cry of distress in his extremity. Nevertheless, Not my will, but yours be done. That was Jesus consigning himself to the cross, wasn't it? Nevertheless, Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. And when I see David here before his arrogant wife, sinking himself into the Lord Jesus Christ, for that's how I see it, in the full flush of the Lord's blessing on him for honoring God's ark, I see a man crucified with Christ. And I stand back and remain silent. David, you've reached the depth. But poor Michael, she didn't understand. She didn't understand what had moved the man, her husband, in his ecstasy. She hadn't a clue. And you know, if the so-called Toronto blessing was anything like that, David's experience that day, then we would have to own it as of God. I'm reading Ian Murray on the last great revival in America, which ushered in the 1859 and 1860 revival here and touched Ireland, England and Scotland, not least the Moray Firth area, Huntly and Aberdeen, when people fell down on Union Street, 1860, with conviction of sin. But you see, this that Ian Murray is writing is a way back before that, to 1788 in Virginia, Bill, where vast numbers flocked into the fold of Christ from every quarter. In many places in this circuit, as soon as the preacher begins to speak, the power of God appears to be present, which is attended by trembling among the people and falling down. You think that'll ever happen in Gilkinson? Some lie void of emotion or breath. Others are in strong convulsions. And thus they continue till the Lord raises them up, which is attended with emotions of joy and rapture. However, Ian Murray gives the other side of that when he says, in all revivals there are admixtures. It cannot be supposed that in the high excitement attending a work of the Spirit of God, God's saving work can be instantly distinguished from what moves men only temporarily, or from what can be accounted for in psychological terms. The depth of feeling shown by professed converts, he says, and physical phenomena such as falling and swooning provide no safe means of distinguishing the permanent from the transitory, he says. That's from his book, Revivals and Revivalism. However, speaking to Dr. John Kelly of Bangor about this, since there has been a good deal of telephoning going on concerning the Toronto blessing meetings in both Elgin and Edinburgh, and John has people who might be interested in that sort of thing, John says, I remain open-minded about the Toronto blessing, except, he adds, that you have taught me that the Word is the thing, and if we keep to that, we won't go astray. Now, that was kind of John to say that, wasn't it? Of course, what he means is that the Word and the Spirit go together. And I believe, you know, it is the life of prayer in a congregation which keeps the two, the Word and the Spirit, together in sweetest harmony. Would you agree with that? I hope you would. Say it again, that it is the life of prayer in a congregation which keeps the two, the Word and the Spirit, in sweetest harmony. And if so, Toronto blessing or no Toronto blessing, we can go steadily on with our work, whoever comes, from whatever quarter, Toronto or Timbuktu. Mostly people come from afar here to learn, although we are willing to learn from any. But it will have to be very biblically balanced to influence us at all. We are not going to allow ourselves to be swept about with every wind of doctrine and practice that blows around. But pursuing the course which for many years has been so amply proved to be the right one, seeing nothing anywhere like the effects of the Word and Spirit of God on people's lives, when the prayer life of the people keeps that Word and Spirit swinging sweetly on their pivot. The Word and the Spirit then do their alternating work in people's souls and lives. The Spirit interpreting and applying the Word to our individual and corporate lives unto that maximum growth in grace which transcends all and is pleasing to God. So my prayer this morning with regard to that is, Lord, keep a steady hand on us, and we shall yet prosper more and more. Amen.